Hello.
Evokes a wide range of responses depending on how old you are. For those of us who listened to AM radio in the 50s and 60s, he was a superstar crooner. For readers of the tabloids, he was the man who married and famously divorced Debbie Reynolds, Elizabeth Taylor, and Connie Stevens. And to younger folks, he's Carrie and Jolie Fisher's dad. He's recounted his show business rise and kind of fall in a memoir that also serves as an insider's guide to two decades of American pop culture and celebrity royalty. His book, Been There, Done That, is from St. Martin's Press and brings Eddie Fisher to New York & Company today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard.
We should mention that it's also written with David Fisher, who's no relation.
No.
You must have been aware of the coincidence when you were working
yes,
on it.
Yes, I was.
Do you think that your career was damaged more by the scandals and excesses or the ascendance of rock and roll?
Well, I think it could have been a little of both, a lot of both, or a little of both. Depends on how you look at it.
Because you couldn't have adapted to rock and roll. It was just so different from what you
but
were
I
about.
But I think that if a person wants to, and he has the talent, he doesn't have to be a part of rock and roll or a part of something else. I felt that I could work anywhere. I thought I was talented enough to work around or through that.
But even Frank Sinatra had a bad period because of rock and roll.
Right.
You say on the first page of the book that everything in your life, positive and negative, you owe to the fact that when you opened your mouth, the sound, this music came out. You didn't have to work at it. You didn't even have to practice. It was there, always there. So is that just a matter of luck?
It was a matter of luck, but it was also a matter of not too bright thinking. Have it there, have your voice there. It was always there. You must take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't. I abused my philosophy always was, I mean, not now, but everything in excess. And
perhaps because that things came so easily to you, you felt you could do no wrong.
That's right. That's what I felt that.
Although things were fairly tough for a while, you grew up in a very large and poor family in Philadelphia?
Well, but I knew at one point and early in my life that I was going to be out there in show business. I knew I was going to be a big star
mm-hmm.
with my voice.
You were already singing professionally when you were a little kid, and you had no worries that your voice was going to change and you were going to lose it all?
My music teacher in South Philadelphia High School, he used Jay Speck. He always, you're going to lose your voice.
Uh-huh.
He kept, but it didn't happen. Thank God.
You're a little kid, and you opened up your mouth, and out came this big voice from the start. And in the early days, doing local fairs and bar mitzvahs and things like that.
Oh, I did anything that came my way, but mostly, I got a tremendous amount of experience on the radio. I was a radio baby, and I loved it. I had three shows, commercial shows, on the air in Philadelphia, and I was making $25 a week.
Well, that was a lot for a family that kept on having to move from place to place because they never could pay the rent. But was your family happy about the fact that you were bringing in the money? Were they show business folks?
Oh no, they weren't show business at all. I was the only one, but. $25 did help out. I would get 15 cents from my father.
You know, mm-hmm.
give
he was in a generous mood.
Yes.
Actually, you had a number of big breaks whenever they ask you what was your big break. You had a big break when Eddie Cantor took you under his wing. You had a big break when you went to Grossinger's to work, when you went to the Copa. But the biggest break was Milton Berle, wasn't it?
No, it was Eddie Cantor.
Really?
But actually, I did an early Milton Berle show before I became Eddie Cantor's protege. And he's always, not lately, but he always used to bring up that he discovered me. He put me on the air first.
Well, he was the biggest thing on television in the early days of television, and he was your first national exposure.
Yes, but actually, Eddie Cantor took me under his wing and took me on tour with him. he wasn't really sure of me until about the fourth or fifth show, when the reaction, he thought I was a local thing at Grossinger's, mm-hmm. in the Catskills, but he found that the reaction was the same everywhere that we went, all over the country, and that's when he wanted to become my manager.
And you turned him down.
Yeah, I called Milton Blackstone, and he said, don't sign anything.
Well, a lot of people offered you the opportunity of management. Frank Costello.
I didn't think you were going to bring that up. Frank Costello, yes, he wanted to be my manager. He saw me at this special night at the Copa, and I really knocked everybody out cold in this. There were a lot of stars that appeared, Sinatra and Vic Damone and Jackie Gleason, Eddie Duchin. Those were just the ones that were performed. There were all kinds of celebrities in the audience that night. And Joey Lewis came out on the stage and said, now here's a kid that's going to cut them all. And I was shocked when he said that. I didn't know he knew. He was very quiet about me, even though I shared the dressing room with him. But when he said that, I had to go out and hit a home run.
Mm-hmm. He had inspired you. He may have just said it because he was being a good MC.
Yes, yes.
But Frank Costello is a hard guy to turn down because, as they say, he made offers that you can't refuse.
I turned it down.
And you didn't pay the price.
No, here I am. No, I think that this a man named Jack and Trotter, who was worked at the Copa, a great big guy, he came back to the dressing room and he said, Frank Costello wants a manager. And I said, I have a manager in Philadelphia. He said, get rid of him. You know, but I couldn't do that. And I mean, I was not frightened by Frank Costello. I thought it was a great compliment.
Mm-hmm. How serious were you about the singing? After all, you had this natural instrument which got you a long way. But did you think much about style? Did you listen to Frank Sinatra,
yes.
and Billie Holiday,
Dinah
Washington, Al Jolson, Eddie Cantor, who you'd worked with?
I listened to everybody, but Dinah Washington and Billie Holiday had no effect on me.
Because they were too jazz-oriented.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Nat King Cole was a brilliant genius. But I listened to everybody.
And Perry Como was probably a major influence.
Major, major, yes. Crosby, Como, Jolson, Sinatra, Nat Cole. There were others that I liked. I liked Dick Haymes. He was a fine singer.
You went from being a guy who had a following to somebody who was a superstar, almost overnight.
Yeah.
What was that like? Because I can't imagine suddenly finding yourself with millions of female fans screaming every time you open your mouth and being emotionally prepared for that sort of thing at the age of 21.
Well, I wasn't, and I used to find myself laughing a lot, you know, to myself of what is this all about? Why are they screaming? And yet, I had had experience, even when I was a young boy in Philadelphia, I had my picture on the trolley cars, and you'd find lipstick all over them. And here I was. That didn't really make an effect on me, but later on, it was pretty heavy stuff. You know, to have seen Sinatra in his prime, and to imagine that I was getting that kind of attention was pretty scary, but it was a pretty wild, wonderful feeling.
Was it the same sort of thing that a rock star would go through today? I imagine.
Absolutely.
Even though in those days women were a bit more, less likely to be forthcoming.
Oh, no. Bobby socks.
They were throwing their
different.
Bobby socks at you the same as girls would today?
Completely different. You know, they were. There was an invisible curtain between us.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I remember a lot of those kids, and but it was all so innocent. As today, it's not.
Well, it was innocent for them, but how innocent was it for you?
It was innocent for me also.
Because here you are, suddenly you have everything that you could ever dream of, all the money you ever wanted. You can date any woman you want to meet, or almost. And that not only has to be overwhelming, but it has to give you a sense of almost invincibility.
Absolutely. That's I haven't heard that word before in this connection, but that's the feeling.
Mm-hmm. Until your voice started acting up.
Well, but that was later on. That was much later on.
Well, not much later on. It was about 4 or 5 years later on. The Korean War intervened.
And my voice, what did you say my voice?
Started acting up. When you were already a big star, your voice suddenly started acting up. You must have really panicked.
What do you mean acting up?
Well, you had problems with it. You wound up going to see the famous
right.
Dr. Max Levinson, Dr. Feelgood.
Yeah, but it was only a natural thing. I was trying to sing over 3,500 Bobby Soxers at the Paramount, 5 shows a day, 7 days a week, and on the 7th day...
Even God relaxed in the 7th day. You went hoarse.
Yes. No, I didn't. On the 7th day, my voice was gone.
Uh-huh.
And that's how I got mixed up with Dr. Feelgood, Dr. Needles.
You weren't the only person who went to him.
Oh,
he made a lot of celebrities happy.
Oh, yes. All the people on Broadway, not only the actors and actresses, but the producers, the directors and writers, senators, congressmen, and finally a president.
Mm-hmm. JFK, yep. They all went to Max Levinson. Max Jacobson.
Yes.
He gave you a shot of amphetamines to relax your vocal cords, and that worked?
I don't know. Didn't know what he gave me. He said, pull down your pants, roll up your sleeve. He gave me an intravenous injection and an intramuscular injection. He said, now sing. And my voice came back just better than it was. And I said, hey, this is for me for life.
And it was almost.
Yeah.
You were hooked on speed amphetamines for 37 years on and off.
Well, from speed, I graduated to cocaine. I guess they're about the same. They're both not too good for you.
Well, one is even more addictive. I think the speed is more addictive than the cocaine, isn't it? When did you realize that you had a drug problem?
When I got back from Rome, I had taken a couple of sedatives and vodka to kill the pain. And
what were you doing in Rome?
My wife was doing Cleopatra.
Mm-hmm. That wife.
Yeah, that one. And I hung around for a while, and then I went back to New York, and I was addicted to the sedatives, the Seconal. And so Max Jacobson got me off of that, but he got me on methamphetamine.
So there was 10 years before you realized that you had a drug problem, wasn't it? Somewhere around
there.
Well, you started at 53.
53 to 60, yes, almost 10 years. But What happened in Rome, really, that was when I realized I had become addicted.
Meanwhile, you were on top of the world. You'd gone off to Korea and performed for the troops. You thought that was going to end your career, but actually you had a string of hit records.
Oh, yeah.
And you wound up, your first number one hit was Wish You Were Here. You didn't even want to record that.
That's right.
Why?
Well, RCA had a interest in the show, and the show didn't get rave reviews. It was a failure, and then RCA had me record it, which I didn't want to do, and it saved the show. And that's the only time in history of Broadway that's happened.
Well, they were telling you what to sing. We'll come back to that and talk about, of course, some of the famous women in your life and other matters. First, we have to take a little break here. My guest is Eddie Fisher. His book, Been There, Done That, is from St. Martin's Press.
Is it I spend the day wake up and end the day thinking of you.
Hello, I'm Janet Lee, and you're listening to New York & Company with Leonard Lopate on WNYC AM 820, New York Public Radio.
I'm walking behind you on your wedding day. Hear you promise to love and obey.
We're back with Eddie Fisher, whose book, Been There, Done That, tells the story of his life that has been lived out famously in the tabloids for quite a few years. Many people don't remember just how big you were. But in the 50s and 60s, you had a string of hits, beginning with Wish You Were Here. And I think probably the biggest one of all was Oh My Papa.
Actually, the biggest selling one of all was I'm Walking Behind You.
On Your Wedding Day.
Yeah.
I remember that song. We had our own version of it, which I can't say on the
air.
Oh,
I know our version of it, too.
That was your biggest hit. Records didn't sell the way they do today, because now even a minor hit will sell a million records.
Yeah.
But you were regularly selling a million records?
I was selling, I had 22 hits in a row, which was the longest string of hits in the history of the music business. I don't know about now, but I'm sure there are other records that were much... When I say records, I mean, I don't mean recording records. I mean...
Mm-hmm. Like Guinness Book of World.
Yes, yes. But this was... anything that I recorded became a hit.
Mm-hmm. How long a span was that?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
Well, it had to be at least 10 years or so. How did you wind up getting the material you got? Were you just simply given them by an A&R man at RCA?
Yes, it was.
Eddie, sing this song and
shut up. It was mostly that. That's at the A&R men. Joe Sita and, I can't remember, Charlie Grion. There were quite a few of them. And they saw a formula in me. And they kept giving me these songs that were almost similar.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't mind it because you were riding on top of the world.
Well, I couldn't say no. I mean, here I was being successful, and I didn't know how to say no. I wasn't Frank Sinatra.
you understood that you didn't have the kind of singing style that Frank Sinatra had. That you were a crooner who could do certain things.
And... I became a belter,
mm-hmm.
And I sang out. I was a well-known crooner, but I also, when I crossed over from the Bobby Soxers and went into doing concerts and in nightclubs and theaters, I had to do other material, and so I was very happy about that I could work to nightclub audiences and become successful doing that.
A bit more sophisticated. But you actually came on the scene when television was just coming on the scene. When you came back from Korea, television was really starting to break out, and you wound up working a lot in television. There were movies as well.
But my manager said to me before I came out of the Army, he said, you're going to be on the air on television for Coca-Cola. And I didn't know what he was talking about, because there had been no conversation, no rumors, no, he just said that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what happened. A week after, yes, April 10th, I got out of the Army, 1953, and April 17th, I was on for Coca-Cola.
How did you hook up with Debbie Reynolds?
How did I hook up with Debbie Reynolds? Well, I think I fell in love with her, with a lot of other GIs over in Korea. We all watched Singing in the Rain, and mm-hmm. but I saw something in her there that and I wanted to meet her. So did everybody else.
Well, you say that everyone from Humphrey Bogart to Prince Philip warned you not to marry her.
Yes.
So why didn't you listen?
I didn't listen too well when it came to who I was seeing or who I was dating or who I was going to marry.
You've described her as a self-centered, totally driven, insecure, untruthful phony.
Well, I think it could be said better than that.
She told me on the show when she visited some years ago that right after you were married, you parked her in a place in L.A. and came to New York to play cards with the boys. And that wasn't the honeymoon that she'd imagined.
No, I may have played cards in my home, mm-hmm. but I didn't leave Los Angeles and come to New York to play cards.
Well, how long before you decided that your marriage to her was a disaster?
Almost right away.
You hadn't.
In spite of that we were going to have a child, and on our supposed honeymoon, things were not right.
Mm-hmm. You had two kids.
Yes.
One of whom is Carrie, who's become pretty famous. What does the other one do?
Todd. Todd is. He was running her hotel and casino in Las Vegas, and he built a museum there. And he's a great architect and electronic engineer, and he's a brilliant boy in every respect.
You're right here. The thought of having a love affair with Elizabeth Taylor never entered your mind.
Right.
Why?
She was married, and she married my best friend, Mike Todd.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no thought at all.
But you wound up with her fairly soon after he died.
Yes, well, because we had been friends. We had been very close.
Mm-hmm.
And she was, you know, wonderful. Even at the funeral, or going to the funeral, Howard Hughes arranged the plane to bring everybody to Chicago for the funeral. And she came into everybody's room to make sure that they were comfortable. I don't know if she knew what she was doing, but she did it well.
Mm-hmm.
And but that still had, it didn't enter my mind till 6 months later when she came to Las Vegas to make her first public appearance at my show at the Tropicana in Las Vegas.
And it's a picture of her with you that you've put on the book jacket here.
Yes.
You reveal all sorts of unflattering things about her in the book, and in response she has said, "I think Eddie Fisher must have been in another world when he wrote his book." And then she goes on to snap, I don't know if you've heard this, "Have you ever noticed that he's the only ex-husband I don't talk about? I can't seem to get his name out of my mouth, but I would never make up stories about him. I wouldn't have to, and I hope he gets better." She's angry with you.
Well, that's getting something out of her. I mean, all I did while I was with her was love her.
Mm-hmm.
Like I loved no one else ever. And I can't understand that I was coming from another world or any of the things that she's saying.
Well, you're a big star, but she was on another level. And everything that you did made it into the newspapers, didn't it?
Yes.
You had no privacy.
Yes. During that period with Debbie and Elizabeth, there was no privacy.
But you did not know that you took up with Richard Burton? You say everybody else seemed to know. You were the last to know?
Isn't that...
You weren't reading the newspapers? Or you weren't believing them?
Well, it was before the newspapers had it, that I found out just before.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine called me at home and told me that the whole Via Veneto was talking about Elizabeth and Richard. And I asked her, after I got off the phone, I asked her if it was true, and she said yes. So I packed and left.
Well, you name quite a few women you've been involved with over the years, even the late Judith Exner of Mob and JFK fame. None of that was happening while you were married to Debbie or to Elizabeth? Is that
no.
all something?
That was after.
Mm-hmm.
That was after.
In reaction, you were devastated by her leaving you?
Oh, I was devastated. I think we talked earlier about the beginning of my addictions. I mean, it became evident, and I was hit very hard by it, of course.
So what happened with Connie Stevens? Was that a marriage that was doomed from the start?
I think so. We had a wonderful relationship before we got married. And then we got married, and we had two kids, but we couldn't put 2 days together.
Mm-hmm.
But was a wonderful, wonderful mother. She raised the kids, and she did everything in her power to have those kids be with me. The opposite of what the other woman did.
Mm-hmm. So you were a father to your kids with Connie Stevens?
Well, no, I wasn't. Not, I,
not as good as you could have been.
I failed. I failed miserably, and that's one of the great regrets I have. I think it would be my top regret.
Mm-hmm. Is this book to some degree an act of contrition?
Could be. Also, I think there's a lesson to be learned from the book I was pretty hard on myself in the book, and rightly so. I was telling the truth. And so I failed. I failed in a lot of ways, and a lot of regrets.
You also, as I said, name quite a few women you've been sexually involved with over the years, and most of them are alive. Did you ask some of the more famous living ones for permission to reveal these secrets?
No, I did not.
Do you think they're upset?
I don't know. You know, when I was Eddie Fisher...
mm-hmm. When you were...
Yes.
The Eddie Fisher.
It was okay, you know, to be associated with me. But I notice people now are coming forth and saying that they slept with Elvis, you know.
I see. Well, you seem to have put your life together in recent years.
Oh, yes.
You kicked the amphetamines and the other drugs.
The cocaine, yes. And I did that. Actually, my wife now had a great deal to do with that. She ran after me and, you know, are you on drugs? Are you on drugs? And I'd say, no, I'm not. I'm on Tylenol.
Did you tell her all about your past before you got married?
Oh, yeah. She knew. To one extent to the other, you know, if you tell my life halfway through to her, it's the same as the whole thing because it's all a bit much. But she's a marvelous, understanding woman, and she's beautiful in every single way. She's a great partner for me, and we love each other, and I'm lucky to find this woman at this time in my life.
What about singing? You still performing?
Well, I the book took up most of my time mentally, and I haven't sung for a while, but I'm going to go back. I want to do Las Vegas. I've had offers to do Las Vegas and concerts, and I want to wind up finally at Carnegie Hall again. Mm-hmm. I was there in 1954, but that's a few years ago. I'd like to wind up one more time at Carnegie Hall.
Well, you know how you get there. You got to practice.
Uh-huh. Right on.
Eddie Fisher's memoir is called Been There, Done That. It's from St. Martin's Press. It's been a great pleasure having you here, Eddie.
And it's been a great experience with you, Leonard.
They're not making the skies as blue this year. Wish you were here. As blue as they used to when you...
And if you wished you were here for that interview with Eddie Fisher, well, you can see him tonight at the 92nd Street Y at 8 p.m. That's at 1395 Lexington Avenue at 92nd Street. He'll also be signing copies of his book, Been There, Done That, at Barnes & Noble tomorrow, the one at 600 Fifth Avenue at 48th Street. That's tomorrow at 12:30 in the afternoon. And coming up next, George Anastasia talking about Thomas Capano and the murder of Anne Marie Fahey. This is Radio New York, AM 820 WNYC.